Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and World Cup fever is gripping Boston.
It is constantly on at home. The kids have, they made these little bracket sheets, and they're crossing off and editing. There's been some exciting upsets.
Boston Mayor Michelle Wu there telling us about her own family's love affair with the Global Soccer Tournament here on the show earlier this week. Meanwhile, teams from all around the world, including Team USA, drawing crowds to bars across the city and region. Sound there from USA-Iran match as watched at the Phoenix Landing Bar in Cambridge. So let's dive beneath the headlines of men's World Cup fever here in the Commonwealth with Boston Globe sports contributor Frank Dellapa. Frank, welcome.
Welcome. Yeah, good to be here.
So remind me, Frank, how long have you been covering soccer now?
Okay, too long, really. I started at the Globe in the 80s, basically, before the 1994 World Cup came to Boston and the U.S.,
so I do want to note, yep, 94 coming back in 2026, and we'll talk about that. But this means you have the long view. So we've got this interesting men's team, USA, here this year, making big headlines here across the Commonwealth abroad. Why are they capturing people's imagination?
Okay, I just think it's a different era than it was in 94. There's just so much more awareness. I mean, all the young people, you know, and the mainstream media now understands, you know, what this tournament is. It's the biggest sporting event in the world. It's actually bigger than the Olympics, with literally billions of people watching it and that sort of thing. And the other thing is, this is a kind of a young U.S. team that's having some success. The players are playing in Europe, too, so people get to watch them every week. Playing in the Premier League, in Serie A, in Italy, and that sort of thing. And so you kind of know these guys. The average age of the team is like 24, the starting team. So that also kind of captures the imagination. It's a young team, bright future, and they're looking pretty good. They got to the second round.
So 24 average age for the starters, 25 overall. A lot of people may watch sports where there's lots of young players. So put in perspective, how young is this, Frank, for a soccer team?
Yeah, I think, that's not ideal to be that young. The teams that win the World Cup usually average like 27, 20 guys right in the peak of their careers, of their physical ability and that sort of thing. This is a team that's really built for the future. You mentioned earlier, Tiziana, that the next World Cup, 2026, will be in the U.S. This team is really built for that one. That's when they're really going to shine. They should. But this is, they're playing with house money now. No matter what they do, it's a success, and they can only get great experience.
So I'm going to play a little sound here. Producer Andrea Perdomo Hernandez spoke with Kevin Trainer, who's a owner of the Phoenix Landing Club in Cambridge, talking about the inspiration from this team.
I think with their doggedness and, you know, their underdogs, and they're not showing any fear for a young team. You know, it's amazing that 23 years old, you know. Even the old guy, Tim Reams, is playing out of his skin. Like, we've only let in one goal.
Okay, so I'm going to take issue with calling Tim Reams old at 35. Nevertheless, this underdog thing is real. We're pretty used to that with the U.S. men's team, right, Frank?
Right, yeah. They've always sort of had that role. But I think to be accurate, and I'm kind of writing about this for the Globe, is the U.S. was actually favored in the first round in two of those games. So they kind of had that mentality and the image of an underdog, but now they truly are the underdog. Going into this game against the Netherlands, they're big underdogs in this game, and that mentality is going to serve them well. But nobody's expecting that. I think the bookmakers expected the U.S. to actually advance in the first round. Nobody's expecting them to get past the Dutch, though.
And the Dutch are potentially one of the favorites to win the whole thing.
Yeah, the Dutch are always a favorite to at least get to the final. They've made it there three times. They've never won it. So they kind of self-destruct or something happens, but they're always, they expect to get to the final. They expect to beat the U.S. or whoever's in their way in these next two games and get to the final. At that point, you know, they probably won't win it. But the U.S. is just happy just to get through the first round. It's hard to get through the first round and get to the quarterfinals. The U.S. has only done it once. That was in 2002 when they were actually coached by Bruce Arena, who's now the coach of the Revolution, the New England Revolution. But it's only happened once in 90 years. So if they can get past this game, that would be a huge upset.
So we're talking about the World Cup with Frank Dellapa, who is with the Boston Globe. He's Boston Globe sports contributor. We reached out to our texting club. To join that texting club, you send the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. Lots of people with lots of thoughts. So Yolette and Randolph said, while I'm not a big soccer fan, I must admit it's exciting to see this team reach the World Cup. I love sports events that bring people from different backgrounds together to cheer on the home team. I don't think Boston will ever be a soccer city, but it's becoming more and more popular here. I thought that was interesting because our same producer, Andrea Perdomo Hernandez, spoke to Evan Cipriano, who's part of the Boston chapter of the American Outlaws fan club. He says Boston is a soccer community.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that Boston is a soccer city, regardless of how you want to chalk it up. You know, you go out on a Saturday morning, you're going to see bars packed for Premier League games, whether it's, you know, the Phoenix Landing and Cambridge, Liverpool fans or what have you. Like, people love this sport in this city.
So Greater Boston has people from Guatemala, Brazil, Vietnam, Canada, Cape Verde, all soccer-loving countries, more. So are we or are we not ripe for an experiencing world soccer with real love here?
Yeah, I think so. I think the ratings, the Boston ratings and national ratings on the last couple of U.S. games were really high, if you want to go by that. But like I think was just pointed out, if you go out on Sunday morning at 7 a.m., into Back Bay or into Dorchester, you will see, or to Cambridge, bars packed with people watching these games, soccer games, not just Boston. You go out to the suburbs, too. So, I mean, there's a huge history for the game here. I'm not sure it's always been recognized by everybody, but, you know, it's not just ethnic, too. You look at all the university students coming in from everywhere. All the young people growing up with the game and playing the game now, too. It's just part of the culture now, I think, and it's part of the fabric. And so I think having the Revolution not playing in the city and not having a stadium for soccer in the city makes it seem like it's not present there, but it really is in Boston.
So, Frank, one of our listeners, Bernadette in Arlington, said, very excited, we'll be watching Saturday. Soccer's not taken as seriously in the U.S. as football or soccer is in the rest of the world. It's an international sport of choice. Go USA. 10 a.m. Saturday morning, in our last minute or so, people who might be watching for their first time, what should they watch for in the USA-Netherlands game?
Okay, I think the U.S. so far has played pretty defensively, you know, but now they have nothing to lose. So I think they're going to come out and really just try to take it to the Dutch and play a little more attacking soccer, too. And the Dutch, their mentality is, we're not backing down from anybody. We're going to play offensively and try to – it's going to be a wide-open game. I think it'll be really good to watch. There's a lot of tension. You know, it's going to go down to the end. Could go into extra time, too. So maybe penalty kicks. So I would say watch it as a sports fan. You're going to watch a game that should be wide open with two teams, you know, just willing to take chances and go for it.
Because whoever loses in the knockout rounds, all the games that start Saturday, you lose, you're gone, right?
Yeah, you lose, you're gone. Like they say in Argentina, it's win or die. But it's not quite that serious with the U.S. It's win or go home. So you have to win or that's it.
All right. We have been speaking with Frank Dellapa, who's a longtime sport writer for the Boston Globe, a soccer super fan. And can I safely assume that you're going to be rooting for Team USA on Saturday, or do you try to stay neutral, Frank?
Well, I try to stay neutral. What I like about soccer is I watch any game and I kind of go in with my favorites and this and that. But then once the game starts, you kind of see who you like. Whoever's playing better that day, you know, whoever looks like they're doing the right things, that's what I'm going to root for.
All right, Frank, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks. Good to be with you.
You too.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Light that tree!
And we are coming back to Radio Boston with a party. I'm Tiziana Deering, and that is WCVB's coverage of last night's tree lighting on the Boston Common. The tree lighting is a Boston Parks and Recreation joint and just one of many winter activities in the city's parks and outdoor spaces. And here to tell us what's on deck, Jennifer Mishazik, the program manager for Boston Parks and Rec. Welcome back, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Happy holiday season to you.
You as well.
So it was pretty cool last night, huh?
It was phenomenal. It's such a family-friendly, fun event that just brings families together for an amazing tradition, cherishing, you know, our relationships with Nova Scotia. And the event, it's an old-fashioned small town, you know, brings you to the small town awesome vibe.
So I want to hit that Nova Scotia thing. The tree lighting ceremony we're talking about does have this fascinating story. Earlier this week on WBUR's daily podcast, The Common, we covered that Nova Scotia piece. It was from November 30th. You can check it out and hear more depth. So we spoke, Jennifer, with Ryan Woods, who is the Boston Parks and Rec Commissioner, about last night. And he often describes the event as your Super Bowl.
To have this many people outside in America's first park lighting this tree that has significance, that, you know, it's not all just about, you know, lighting the tree. It's about that story of goodwill, helping others, the things that are important during the holiday season. So being out here with over 10,000 people to light this tree, see the pyrotechnic display as the tree gets lit, confetti cannons go off, and have over 10,000 people in unison singing holiday songs. It really gets everybody into the holiday spirit.
So I was so struck by that, Jennifer Mishazik, because when people say, think about your local Parks and Rec department, that's not what they think, right? That kind of bringing people together, those kinds of major efforts. But there's a lot you do in the winter for people.
Yes, we have a vast majority of events from a winter children's festival during February vacation to sporting activities. We have clinics, softball, pickleball, baseball, football. So we try to hit every, you know, aspect that we can. And we also do offer our fitness series, which is very popular in the summer but extends into the winter months.
So what are people looking for from our parks, from our recreational department in the wintertime? What is it they want?
Just to get outdoors. And we have, you know, we have parks and playgrounds within walking distance to every neighborhood within the city of Boston. And, you know, for us, it's promoting it and getting people outdoors to get their bodies moving. And with our winter fitness series, you know, with COVID, we had to change a little bit and pivot like everyone else did, but offer, you know, virtual classes as well. So those who, you know, the rough, you know, days that we have with the weather, that they can keep their bodies moving, whether it's getting out to a facility and participating in our fitness series or virtual as well in their own home.
And the winter fitness series, is it indoors or outdoors?
We offer a hybrid, both.
So because this is interesting, our producer, Bart Tachi, pulled some research from the University of Utah earlier this year, which showed that spending about 2 hours a week outside and in nature can promote better health and overall well-being. So what are some of the other ways people can get outside with Boston Parks and Rec this winter?
Absolutely. We'll be offering a walking group led by our park rangers. Currently, they are doing that now, and our hopes is to keep it going throughout the winter months. But out of Franklin Park, we'll be offering a walking group or snowshoeing. So depending on what the weather brings, snowshoeing will be an option for the couple of months. And they can, you know, access that on our website as well.
So I can already hear listeners saying, okay, you're telling me a lot. I don't have a pen. How do I find out about all of this? Where can people go to find out more and sign up and that kind of thing?
Yep, they could visit www.boston.
I surprised you.
Oh, my goodness.
Didn't I?
Yeah, okay, so I usually can rattle it off.
That's okay.
With no
we
problem.
Got your back here, because this is what we can do. We will put it on radioboston.org. And because you're listening, I know you know Radio Boston. So we're going to have a link to all of this in our show webpage, radioboston.org. So I'm going to play a little bit of sound about the Mayor's Cup. This is from Damian Margardo, who is a colleague of yours.
You know, these are teams from Charlestown, Dorchester, South Boston, High Park, Alston Brighton, and Parkway. And we also have a team from Boston Score, which is for youth that have, you know, this might be their first year ever stepping on the ice. So, and that's usually inner city youth also from all different neighborhoods. So it is an incredible event.
It sounds pretty amazing. Tell us what that is.
Oh, our mayor. So we offer Mayor's Cup for a lot of sports, you know, softball, baseball, but our ice hockey tournament is mind-blowing. We have over 80-plus teams within the tournament that will take place within a two-week time span at the end of December. So having 80-plus teams in one tournament is amazing, and Damien does a phenomenal job at, you know, organizing those brackets, but bringing the neighborhood together and looking forward to this free, fun tournament. Battling within the neighborhoods.
So free seems important. I mean, ice hockey is exciting, but it can be expensive. It's time-consuming. Is it an accessible sport for all of Boston's youth today?
That is why offering this tournament, you know, giving, you know, your local tournament an opportunity where there's no fees. You know, they can access it without a problem. And ice time is expensive. So, you know, being able to work with these neighborhoods and these ice rinks and a local university to be able to host these tournaments close by is very important.
So what about you? Any Meshazik family traditions that you're looking forward to this time of year?
My daughter plays on two hockey teams, so she'll be taking part in this hockey tournament
as
well.
Is this her first time? Has she ever done it before?
This will be her second year.
So how did they do last year?
She was on the all-girls team last year, and they did pretty well. I was proud of them.
And
they're going to do phenomenal this year.
They
won the states, and I think that the girls' team's going to take it all this year, but don't hold me to it.
All right, a little bit of prognosticating from Jennifer Meshazik, who is the program manager for Boston Parks and Recreation Department. Again, you can find more about all the programming that they have available for you this winter season at our website, radioboston.org. Jennifer, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Richard Boulanger, Dr. B, to his students, teaches one of those classes that students can't get enough of. It's circuit bending and physical computing at the Berklee College of Music. And when he joined us in Studio 2 earlier this week for our latest Brilliant Boston, he started by putting a weird device on my forehead, and it just got wilder from there.
Well, we're actually listening to your brain waves.
They don't sound very smart.
Well, no. They're quite amazing. These little cascading arpeggios, are you problem solving right now? We're listening to like your alpha waves. And I've written this little program in C sound in the background, and you're wearing a brainwave sensor on your head, which is the Muse sensor.
It's quite comfortable. I want listeners to know I'm not in any discomfort. It's right around my head, pulled my hair back in a pony. Got it on my forehead underneath my headphones.
This is the version that's designed for meditation and sleeping with, and you can monitor and record your brainwave patterns while you sleep. But the exciting thing about this is there's an app that someone wrote for the iPhone called Mind Monitor, and it takes that brainwave data and sends it via a communication protocol, like via the internet, if you will, over to my laptop. And so that's where I'm monitoring you and catching you and sort of sampling you. Now, the truth is, if we were just to listen to your brainwaves without my
value add.
Okay, yeah, right. Without my C sound in the background, it would sound something like this. Just this turbulence, mm-hmm. This noise, because, you know, this is our brain, electrical activity in our brain. But, you know, what I've tried to do is take that and, you know, sort of channel it, if you will, and get the streams of data and then listen to your thoughts and sort of build a little bit of arpeggios out of them. So, for instance, if you'd like, we could listen to a different brain band, if you will. These are alpha waves, generally when you're problem solving and focused, and like we are now in this conversation, we're thinking about answering the question.
And what's the next question I'm going to ask?
Yeah, all that. But yeah. If we invite you to maybe meditate for a second, and I tune in maybe to your theta waves, we could then see maybe a little bit of a different kind of slower patterning and things like that. Let's see if this works.
So I'm going to try to meditate here.
Okay.
Of course, now the challenge with this is as soon as I start to ask you questions,
we're lost.
No, I'm not meditating
anymore. Right, we're moving. But you know what I was noticing there? before, patterns were like, and here we're hearing more of a something a little more oscillating and wave like, almost, you know, like a breathing,
which is what I was doing, right? I do mindfulness meditation, so I was focusing on the inhale and the exhale,
and I was kind of hearing a little of that in the little bit of the patterns. Now, when you listen to brainwaves and brainwave music, I'm still trying to compose with it. I'm still trying to inspire my students to think about how to take sensor data. We wear it on our Apple Watches and on our Aura Rings, and we're having all this data now. How could you kind of turn that into music? How could you put a musical knowledge behind it?
And this is stuff that in the later part of your course, I'm assuming you're beginning to teach your students how to do.
Absolutely. So in the beginning of the class, they build circuits, they make synthesizers, they learn soldering, they work with a breadboard, and we can describe all of this in a minute. But they've all used synthesizers forever. And since they were three, right? They've all grown up with them, but how do they really work? What would it be like if I made one? And also, could I discover some old toys that I was playing with that I could rewire in some way and make new music with them? So that's a little bit of the first half of the class, but then the second half is really about sensors and control, and can I make new ways of playing sound, mm-hmm. of controlling and shaping the sounds that
like
I'm creating.
My brainwaves.
Exactly. And so that's when I have them build theremins and build alternate controllers and use proximity detectors and heart rate detectors and any kind of biosensor we can. I show them how to tap into that, how to get that data, how to filter the data, and how to maybe map it in a musical way, which I'm going to show you with your brainwave.
So show our listeners with my brainwaves.
Okay.
I am the brainwave guinea pig. Here.
Okay, hold on. Let me make sure I've called up the right interface for it. There it is. Okay. And so now streaming the same original alpha waves, mm-hmm. We start like this.
So those are my brainwaves.
That's your brainwaves making this little bass pattern, which maybe feels a little like a trombone.
It does feel a little like a trombone, yes.
And now we'll add a melodic part.
That is very chipper.
Right? I hope that's how you're feeling. Now, we'll bring in some inner voices.
Of course, you know, I'm like, do not bring in any of my inner voices.
No. yes, right. But, and...
Yes. So you are literally composing with the data that you are gathering from five different sensors reading different levels of my brainwaves.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
That's a thing people can do.
Yes, we can all do that now. And
amazing.
I can imagine my home or my car or my, you know, I imagine that, you know, that all of those interesting things that we dream of, you know, they're within reach now. And that's a little bit of what this, you know, what this makes possible.
So I'm going to play.
Yeah. Okay, sure.
I'm actually going to play a little bit of sound here.
Okay,
and this
yeah.
is you in a live sensor jam.
So
tell me what's going on here.
You're hearing my heartbeat.
I can hear it.
Boom. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there's my heartbeat making the drum.
Yeah.
These voices. That's me moving my hands closer or farther away from my synthesizer.
So I'm literally hearing your hands.
Yeah, I'm hearing my hands move in space. I'm not touching anything.
Yep.
And the chord that you're hearing now, these chords, that's my brainwaves.
Okay.
Playing a chord progression. I've wired myself up to a lot of sensors. Now I've got one on my muscles. A muscle sensor.
Okay.
And that's doing a little bit of the woo.
Yeah, I can hear it.
Yeah. That's me making a fist.
All right. So this is literally the music of your body.
This is, I sing, the body electric.
Yeah, I mean, okay. So the name of the class is circuit bending and physical computing.
Yeah.
But that is mind bending.
Yeah.
That you can do that. That we are at a point where we can read the electrical impulses, the brain waves, and to begin to teach people that this is data that can be converted to music.
Yeah.
How has the music world responded to this?
Well, there's certainly a fascination. If you cruise the internet, you'll see my students have invented things that allow plants to make music. And so you can sonify all sorts of things. But I have been finding that a lot of people that are using data aren't necessarily making music with it yet. Even I'm not. You know, it's kind of musical. It's still a big challenge ahead of us on how do I turn this information stream, and many times it's a stream, right? So if my heartbeat keeps beating.
I hope it's a stream. Yeah, that's your heartbeat.
Well, that's right. It's true. We don't want it to stop, but we do like people to take a breath and not run on sentence or chatter all the time. You know, so how do I make it phrase? How do I make it breathe? How do I modulate the chords? How do I do all those things that we consider to be musical that add a kind of richness? And so I'm still...
So that's the holy grail.
That's what we're all challenged with now, and how I show my students it's possible. I show them it can be kind of musical, and then I'm counting on them.
So you believe one of these days, a student's going to graduate from one of your classes, and they're going to figure out how to turn the body electric into a concerto.
Yes, absolutely.
How far out do you think we are from that?
I think we're closer than you think. I think we're a lot closer with artificial intelligence, machine learning, smarter algorithms, and smarter students, as has been surprising me over the last 37 years that I've been at Berkeley. There's always brilliance and inspiration every semester, every class. But wow, now there's a lot.
So let's pick that up. You gave us a little sound, and you had permission from your students to share
this.
So this is from Zaire Sherman, and he circuit bent a kid's toy, a baby Einstein piano.
Yeah.
I'm assuming in the first half of your class
exactly.
when you're teaching them the basics. So here's a little bit of that.
Dog.
All right, so then we can do these little momentary switch things.
All right, so what is Zaire doing and learning with this baby Einstein piano here?
Well, I think he's learning, I think mostly he's learning, wow. I hope if one thing he's learning, it's funny because I tell my students, you know, circuit bending is where we kind of rewire toys, and it's really a fun class of kind of discovery. Now, of course, I want to warn your studio audience, only toys that run on batteries and only toys, you know, nothing you plug into the wall. And so...
Please listen to the professor on this.
Very important. And also, when you open up these old toys and you start poking around and rewiring the circuit or redirecting the flow, you're going to discover all of these sound worlds in there that you had no idea existed, and that's what Zaire is discovering.
All right, so we've got one more here. This is student Ben Hartman, who took a Speak and Spell, a new Nintendo DS, and a circuit board, and connected them to some knobs and wires and things inside a plastic container. and here's what that sounds like. Now, this is music.
Oh, yeah.
Right? With toys.
Absolutely. With junk.
Yep.
With something that someone had thrown away.
So you studied originally at the New England Conservatory. And a couple of weeks ago, we had a friend of the show who's a professor at the New England Conservatory on Mehmet Ali Sanlıkol, a Turkish jazz musician. And recently, he created a new instrument called the Sanlıkol Renaissance 17. And here he is talking about what it's like to play an instrument that's never existed before. Here he is.
Music is such a big world of different colors and different possibilities. And so in this kind of world of experiments and so on and so forth, it's more about being mature and thinking about how can I communicate the very essence of this music.
So what he had created was a microtonal digital keyboard.
Beautiful.
Yep. And so I'm wondering what becomes possible with the things that you're learning to do and the things that you're teaching students. I mean, we talked about the fact that he imagined music 23 years ago he couldn't compose and play because he didn't have the instrument to play it on.
Right.
What's in your imagination that's becoming possible now that maybe when you studied as a student, you couldn't even begin to put into sound?
Right. If you're infected by sound, if you're, you know, if sounds do something to you, and they do to a musician, they inspire us. All sounds have such, well, there's music in every sound. That's where these alternate controllers come in, this idea of maybe with our brain waves or with our thoughts themselves. But how can I shape sound? How can I sculpt the sound? And that's my big dream of the future. It's to be, have as much fun making music, to be as expressive and joyful and jam and play with others like we always did. That's what music made possible, that we kind of invent together. We harmonize, right? Those are all the most positive things we want in the world, in society, to be harmonious and get along and make beautiful music together, metaphorically and realistically. But how do I play a sound? How can I just turn my hand and shape in the same way that I can with a guitar or a trumpet that I grew up with? But how can I do that now with a sound that's... Well, how can I make that sound for you? Well, maybe with a sensor, maybe... And so a lot of this class is all about getting them to touch the sound. And also, you know, there are individuals with physical disabilities. So how can you take our musicality and create controllers that let someone who has trouble moving their hand or moving their arm or limited mobility, or maybe they were even a wounded warrior, how can I make music again and play sound expressively? Well, these same technologies make that possible too. And so this is the world I imagine, that these sensors and these physical computing intelligence and awareness gets channeled through my Berkeley students into a really beautiful playground for everyone.
That was Berklee College of Music professor Richard Boulanger, who teaches the popular class Circuit Bending and Physical Computing. And now the sound of his brain from what he calls a life sensor jam. And that's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. On behalf of the whole Radio Boston team, thanks for listening.